Good afternoon, folks. I see we've got attendees signing on, so we'll give a few minutes so that there's an opportunity for our folks to get here. So my clock shows that it is 2 o'clock. I am going to start our session for today, and I would like to welcome everyone today to what is for the Grandview Heights Marble Cliff Historical Society an historic event. We are doing our annual meeting for the first time virtually. We will be handling today's session in two segments. We will start with a short business meeting, which is the true part of the annual meeting for the society, followed by a very interesting presentation. I think you'll all be quite fascinated with what you hear today during the historical presentation. I'm Kent Studebaker. I'm president of the Grandview Heights Marble Cliff Historical Society. I wanted to acknowledge our board members right up front. They are Terry Alexander, who is treasurer, Jackie Cherry, Jane Harris as secretary, Ruth Ann James, Brian Kuiper, Jill Kuiper, Tracy Liberator, vice president, Karen Riggs, and Kim Sides. These are the folks that are the real heart and soul of the organization in terms of putting together our programs and having the presence in the community. As we start today, I'm going to do a quick overview of the last 12 months for the society. It's going to be rather short today with the advent of the COVID-19 and many of the restrictions. What we had planned to see happen in 2020 has been curtailed quite considerably. One of the things that we really had hoped to do this year was to have our founders room, which is our archives room in the Grandview Library, open to the public one Sunday a month. Give the opportunity for the public to see what kind of archive we have, what kind of historical memorabilia we have in the archives room, get an idea of what history can be researched there, and just the idea of knowing that the organization is truly the repository for the local history for Grandview Heights and Marble Cliff. One of the other items that we did this year was to ask the community to share with us some of their COVID stories. This is going to be an historic event as we move forward from this. And having those types of stories in our archives would certainly be a valuable asset for the society. Those are the types of things that the community contributes to our archives. And information on how this can be done can be gleaned from our website. And that is a really good way to see what the society has to offer, but also a way to communicate with the society those types of pieces of information that are valuable for the society to have in their archives. This year, we're analyzing our communications. As many of us know, with the restrictions that have been imposed during the COVID times, a lot of the communication has moved to electronic. Social media is something that the society does have a bit of a presence, but we're looking at whether or not that is something that we should move to more readily. Right now, you can find information about the society and a considerable amount of information from our archives on the website. Facebook, I would suggest you follow the society. There are snippets of information and history that are presented on the society. Also, if you're the recipient of the This Week newspapers in Grandview and Marble Cliff, our Moment in Time is published almost weekly in that, and it can be acquired both in the hard paper copy or online. We've learned that the events that we had hoped to do in 2020 just will not be happening. And so we're looking more to how we can achieve those types of events for the community in 2021. So I would ask you to keep an eye out for what we're thinking about having as a person-to-person opportunity for events in 2021. Again, a number of those types of information can be found on our website. During the last 12 months, we have had the opportunity to have the organization in the forefront publicly. There are two events in particular that had a great deal of presence and have been a highly successful offering of the society. They have been coordinated by board member Karen Riggs, and I'm going to ask Karen to talk about those two items at this point. And you can see that we do have, when we have the opportunity, we do like to step into some considerable publicly oriented activities. Karen, if you will.
Sure, thanks. Thank you, Kent. And hello, everyone. Welcome this afternoon. I'm pleased to be able to share information on two of the signature activities that the Society undertook in the last 12 months. I want to share my screen here quickly, so let me get that going here. So I will start with the 2019 Tour of Homes. The Society holds a Tour of Homes every 3 years. Features homes in Grandview Heights and the Marble Cliff area. Our 2019 Tour of Homes was held on Sunday, October 6th. It was fortunately a beautiful fall day, so we benefited from amazing weather, and we certainly benefited that it was pre-COVID, because I don't know how we would have managed the tour a year like this year. As Kent mentioned, the Tour of Homes for 2019 was very successful. We about tripled the attendance of our last tour, which was 2016. We had the most homes ever on tour. We had 6 beautiful historic homes on the tour, and it was just tremendous to have that many featured on this tour. We had many firsts, called first at the 2019 tour. This was the first time I'd been the director of the tour, and I was wanting to think of ways that we could be more efficient, get a little more recognition for the tour. So for example, one of the things that we did was the first time we ever had advance or credit card ticket sales. And I think a lot of people now do like advance tickets, online ticket purchasing. So we went with that, and we probably sold about 2/3 of our tour tickets that way, which was great. We had a VIP event for the first time ever, and that was a brunch at High Banks Distillery on Good Ale in Grandview Heights. Attendees at the VIP event got a lovely meal, Also, we're able to go and view the tour homes in more of a private viewing before they opened up to everybody that attended the tour. So that was a great success. Among the other firsts that we had is I was fortunate to work with an amazing tour team. Previously, a lot of the effort and planning for our previous tours had largely been done by board members of the society. And I was able to work with a team of about a dozen leads in different areas, for example, our brochure, publicity, different activities, website, and they were great to work with and really helped make the tour bigger and better than it has in the past. We had about 100 volunteers that either worked at the VIP event, were docents at homes, worked the registration desk, and without their assistance as well, the tour would have not gone off as well as it did. And certainly last but not least, our 6 homeowners who gave up their home for almost the entire day on the beautiful Sunday and worked with us quite a bit to make the tour happen. So I'll let you read the rest of kind of the first that we had for the 2019 tour here on the slide. The other thing that we focused on in 2019 is engaging more sponsors. And we really reached out to local business community and ended up with over 35 funding and in-kind sponsors. So our sponsors either gave us cash that were allowed us to do more this year with the brunch and the VIP event, or they donated, for example, products to our owner's swag bag. So our sponsors were a huge help with this tour and also helped promote the word. And I think attendance increased because of the sponsors that we engaged. I wanted to show a few graphics from our 2019 tour here. The one on the left or the far left, I think it's your far left, we did have a professional photographer take photos of all 6 of our homes, both interior and exterior. We used those photos for social media posting and gave them obviously to the owners for their personal use. The one photo here of the doorknob actually was our signature photo. We used that on our tour poster. The graphic with the number 5, that was the Columbus Dispatch the week before the Sunday tour. They featured our tour of homes as one of the top 5 activities to do in the Central Ohio area that particular weekend, which was great because I know I talked to tour attendees from Worcester, from Newark, Marysville. So we really expanded the reach of the tour in 2019. The middle graphic, we had a booth at the Grandview Hop, one of the Friday Grandview Hops. We worked with the Columbus Young Professional Organization on that, and they were a huge help to us. They also provided a number of volunteers on tour day to man the homes or man the VIP event, which was tremendously helpful. And then the last photo there is just one of the signs outside of a tour home. Shows how we tried to acknowledge our sponsors. We had sponsors, signature sponsors for each of the homes and tried to acknowledge their contributions in that way. So that's the 2019 tour kind of in a nutshell. The planning for the tour started actually in 2017. So we spent 2 years thinking about planning, organizing the 2019 tour. Our next tour should be in 2022, which means we'll start planning here as early as next month. So if anyone on the webinar today is interested in serving on the tour team, volunteering the day of a tour, or have a home that you might want us to consider to be part of the tour, we'd certainly welcome you reaching out to the society. I've included the email here. For the tour of homes, feel free to contact me directly there or one of the contact points that Ken noted in his earlier slide. So moving from the tour, The second kind of signature activity that the Society undertook in 2019 or the last 12 months is History Walks. And History Walks is an app that includes walking tour, historical walking tours of the Grandview Heights and Marble Cliff area. It's a free app. You can get it on your Google or Apple App Store. We launched this at the end of August this summer, and we've had approximately 400 downloads to date. This was a joint activity with the Grandview Heights Public Library. They were a tremendous assistance. I worked with their director, and they've done a lot of publicity, did a lot with setting up and formatting the app. We have four tours currently on the app. One is Highlights of Grandview Heights, a second is Highlights of Marble Cliff, and then the other two are our last two tour of homes. So we took the tour of homes, turned them into a route on the app, so you can learn a little bit of information on the different homes and buildings that we had on the 2016 and 2019 tours. You can walk, drive, bike, run, or even just look at the tours at home on your computer, tablet, or smartphone. We have about a dozen additional tours that we've conceptualized or under development, and our plan is to add a new tour to History Walks about once a quarter. So I encourage those of you listening in on this webinar, look for the app, download it, go on the tours. If you've already done so, come back in a month or so and we'll have a new tour for you to enjoy. So again, that's it on History Walks. I appreciate the time to talk about these two activities, and I'll turn things back over to Kent. Thank you.
Karen, thank you. I have a couple a couple housekeeping items to handle at this point before we get to our speaker. The first, I wanted to let you know that the membership structure for the Society has changed for 2020 forward. We have the categories of single person with a $30 annual fee, a family at $60 annual fee, and that's replacing a category that used to be considered a couple. Felt that it was more accurate to have a family category. Then there is one for organization at $75, and finally a benefactor at $1,000. The other change in our membership structure is the repeal of the lifetime membership category that will no longer be offered, but that does not affect any member of the Society who currently has a lifetime membership. All current lifetime memberships are grandfathered into our membership status, and so will be recognized as members of the Society throughout the individual's lifetime. The other item that we have to take care of today is the board has four board positions that are up for election this year. There have been four declared candidates with Terry Alexander, Jane Harris, Ruth Ann James, and Kim Sides. With those being the candidates for these four seats, I will declare them elected without opposition. Now that concludes the business portion of our program today. And now I'd like to introduce Tracy Liberatore, Vice President of the Society, who will introduce our speaker and get us started into what's going to be a very fascinating portion of this program. Tracy, if you will.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. Caroline Van Dusen is a local Grandview resident, and her great-great-grandmother was Mary Todd Lincoln's best friend. She has a fascinating story to tell you. And after her presentation, we will take questions and try and answer as many as we can. Feel free to type your questions at any time. And if we do not get to all of you, we will find a way to answer your question later. And now I'll turn it over to Caroline.
Great. Thank you so much, Tracy. I'm about to share my screen. And once I do, there's really no need to be viewing our gallery view. If you can minimize it or just move it over, because you're going to want to see the full screen. That's all I wanted to say. So, now I'm going to minimize this. Okay.
Hello, thank you for inviting me here today. It's my pleasure to share the Civil War letters and friendship keepsakes that I've discovered over the last 20 years. These are heirlooms that once belonged to my great-grandparents, and I found them in our attic and a cousin's basement and public archives. And each one helps to piece together my family's friendship with the Lincolns during the Civil War years. It's really from their first days in Washington until their last. And it's a story of a lost and found friendship. And it offers a glimpse into the lives of the Lincolns from a new vantage point.
On April 15, 1865, the greatest single tragedy in American history occurred, the assassination of President Lincoln. Today, 155 years after Mary Lincoln and her friend Elizabeth Dixon witnessed the tragedy together, the story of their friendship will be shared for the first time. This is President Lincoln's deathbed. Imagine that you were one of the close friends of President Lincoln that was actually there that night and saw the horror during that night-long vigil. As your good friend took his last breath, well, this woman seated next to Mary Lincoln, she did. She remained through the night with Mary, comforting her, but helpless as the president lay dying. She was a witness to the tragedy that moved the dial of history. But who was she, and what do we know about her friendship with Mary Lincoln? Why was she even at the Peterson House? These are the questions that I will answer for you today. Answers that have taken me 20 years to find. So I invite you to step back in time with me, return to the Civil War years, where we will follow the footprints of Mary Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, and their good friend, seated right there in the middle, Elizabeth L.C. Dixon. Let's take a look at the early years of these women. On the left is Mary Todd Lincoln, and on the right is Elizabeth Cogswell Dixon. Mary Todd Lincoln grew up in Lexington, Kentucky, and this is her home, her childhood home on Main Street. Elizabeth Cogswell Dixon grew up in Saco, Maine when she was 10. Her family, and she moved to Varick Street on St. John's Park in New York City. Both Mary and Elizabeth were academy educated. They studied math and history and science, religion, and of course, French. Mary attended Mentel School for Young Ladies across the road from Ashland Henry Clay's home in Lexington. Elizabeth Cogswell Dixon attended Esther Smith School for Young Ladies at 3 Fifth Avenue on Washington Square. Both Mary and Elizabeth lost their mothers when they were young. Mary's died when she was 6 and Elizabeth when she was 16. Shortly after their mother's death, both of their fathers remarried and soon welcomed half-brothers and sisters into the family. Both Mary and Elizabeth were intelligent and independent and were, for their husbands, very worldly. These were precisely the qualities that attracted them to their future husbands. Mary Todd and Abraham Lincoln were married at her sister's home in Springfield, Illinois. Elizabeth Cogswell married James Dixon at her father's home in South Windsor, Connecticut. It's during the Mexican War that both Mary and Elizabeth's husbands enter the national political scene. They were both elected to the House of Representatives. Lincoln served Congress from 1847 to 1849, and James Dixon served from 1845 to 49. Eager to assist their political careers of their husbands, both wives accompanied them to Washington with their children in tow. Mary had young boys, Robert and Eddie, and Elizabeth Dixon had Bessie and Clemmie and was pregnant with her son, Jamie, which she delivers during her time in Washington. Both women had starkly different experiences in Washington their first years. Mary Lincoln left no writings, except for the letters between she and Abraham when they were apart. She lasted just a short time in the winter of his first term, and then again returned late that summer. Elizabeth Dixon had a very different experience. She brought a nurse and additional help of her sister to help out. While Mary Lincoln made no calls, social calls that we know of during her time in Washington, Elizabeth Dixon kept a detailed diary and logged over 800 calls.
This is her diary. Her diary I transcribed and submitted to the White House Historical Association, and they published it in issue 33. And this is William Seal, the editor, talking about Elizabeth Dixon's diary.
Continuing our interest in the White House neighborhood, as well as the presidential complex itself, this issue of White House History paints a picture of Washington in the era of the Mexican-American War, when American armies were fighting 2,000 miles away on foreign soil. It was an interesting time in Washington. No better visit to the scene can be found than in the diary of Elizabeth Dixon, wife of Congressman James Dixon, a Whig from Connecticut. Their time in Washington precisely coincided with the Mexican War, and her experiences in the wartime capital are vividly detailed. Mrs. Dixon's friends and acquaintances were numerous, so we have included a special portrait gallery of the faces familiar to her. The diary, which is in the collections of the Connecticut Historical Society, is published here for the first time.
There are no references that Mary and Elizabeth ever crossed paths during their first years in Washington, but Lincoln did know James Dixon. He wrote to his friend, William Herndon, in 1848 about the Mexican War. He said, "If you wish a full understanding of the war, the whole or nearly so is to be found in the speech of Dixon of Connecticut." Fast forward to 1861, when the Lincolns arrive to Washington. With them are their three boys, Robert, Willie, and Tad. Sadly, Eddie had died in 1850, just 1 month before his fourth birthday. The Dixons had four children by 1861, Bessie, Clemmie, Jamie, and Harry. Also around the household was Clemmie's future husband, James Clark Welling. On the top left is a card of the outgoing president, James Buchanan, and a carte de visite of his niece, Harriet Lane, who was his White House hostess. Both of these were from an album of Elizabeth Dixon's of carte de visites from individuals that she had collected during the Civil War. And there's a photo of Abraham Lincoln's inaugural ceremony on the Capitol's East Portico. And on the right-hand side is a letter that Mary Lincoln received, that she would be escorted to the inauguration by Senator Dixon and Senator Hale. It reads, "I respectfully inform you that Senators Dixon and Hale will visit you tomorrow morning at 11 to escort you and the ladies of your party to the Capitol. I should get great pleasure having made this communication in person, but for the Senate being in session, very respectfully, Salmon Foote." Now these two Northern senators, Senator Dixon of Connecticut and Senator Hale of New Hampshire, are strangely associated with President Lincoln's assassination. As you know, that Elizabeth Dixon was there as Mary Lincoln's friend at his deathbed, but also Senator Hale's daughter, Lucy Hale, was questioned as a conspirator because she had been a girlfriend of John Wilkes Booth. So here we have the invitation to President Lincoln's inaugural ball, 1861, that Mrs. Dixon received. She attended with her two daughters. Next to her, you see that those are their carte de visites, which is the Civil War version of photograph. So this is Elizabeth Dixon on the top left with Clemmie Clementine Dixon. And next to her is Bessie Elizabeth Dixon. Going to the right is Constance Kinney, Elizabeth Dixon's niece, and Elizabeth Dixon's sister, Mary Kinney, all the way to the right. All five women went to this Union Ball, as depicted in this Leslie magazine drawing from that night. That was the closest other people could get to attending the Union Ball. There was no live TV or broadcast. This was the closest individuals could get, is reading about it in the paper. Now, fast forward. Let's fast forward 4 months to the Battle of Bull Run, also known as the First Battle of Manassas, the first major battle of the American Civil War, and which was a Confederate victory. We have James Dixon on the upper left with a carte de visite of General Winfield Scott and his note that Winfield Scott had issued to James Dixon, a pass dated July 20th, 1861, one day before the battle. And it reads, to be permitted to pass through the U.S. lines to General McDowell headquarters and back is commended to the kindness and consideration of troops. Now, Dixon reported back to Lincoln when he returned to Washington. Also, on the right-hand side, we see James C. Welling, who was Clemmy Dixon's future husband, the editor of the National Intelligencer, wrote up that he had gone out and said the battle, it is said, was planned and commanded on our part for the greater portion of the time by General Sigel, who gave orders to our forces to hold their position and await attack by the enemy, supposed to be Jackson. Instead of this, McDowell, who holds the extreme left, advanced, is attacked by Longstreet's division on the enemy's right. He was met by a terrible throw from the rebels, during which General Slocum's brigade was terribly cut up and McDowell was forced to give way. He was reinforced on a portion of Fitzjohn Porter's division, and any attack was made on the assailants when they were in turn driven back to their original positions. And here is a snippet from Ken Burns' Civil War series about the Battle of Bull Run. And you'll notice that when they mentioned the Connecticut senator, they met James Dixon.
The Confederates formed a meandering 8-mile line along one side of Bull Run Creek. They were less than 25 miles from Washington. And there they waited. Hundreds of Washingtonians in holiday mood rode out to Manassas hoping to see a real battle. Some brought field glasses, picnic baskets, bottles of champagne.
We saw carriages which contained civilians who had driven out from Washington to witness the operations. A Connecticut boy said, "There's our senator." And some of our men recognized other members of Congress. We thought it wasn't a bad idea to have the great men from Washington come out to see us thrash the Reds. Private James Tinkham.
So now let's fast forward a year. It's August 1862. The Congress is not in session. James Dixon, senator, is up in Hartford. He receives this telegram from Abraham Lincoln. Come here. It's the shortest telegram that Abraham Lincoln supposedly ever wrote. We know Lincoln signed his famous Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863. What we forget was freedom came in increments. This draft of the proclamation was written July 25th, 1862, in the hand of President Lincoln, in which he warned the rebels they risked forfeiting their property unless they surrendered. It was a step towards emancipation. It was a prelude to the proclamation. This first official proclamation by the President of the United States was published publicly in the newspaper. To do so, Lincoln gave his handwritten draft to none other than James C. Welling, who published the text of the proclamation in the National Intelligencer newspaper. Welling, then 2 years later, in support of the Union, donated this first draft of history to the New Jersey Sanitary Commission at the Great Fair of Philadelphia, where it was auctioned off, and the winner gave this page from history to the Library Company of Philadelphia, where it can be viewed today in their online collections and has been featured in several public online exhibits. Now, less than a month later, Horace Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune, published an editorial called The Prayer of 20 Millions that criticized Lincoln for protecting slavery in the border states and failing to give full support to the military commanders who supported emancipation. And the 20 million residents of the Union states really wrote were sorely disappointed and deeply pained by the policy you seem to be pursuing with regard to the slaves of rebels. Well, Lincoln replied in a letter back to the editor. But he, instead of giving it to the Tribune office or to Horace Greeley, he gave it to another editor, James Clark Welling, the editor of the National Intelligencer, who published it the following day for Lincoln. Now here is my friend Howard Wright. He is a Lincoln impersonator, and he is reading this famous reply that Lincoln gave to Horace Greeley. And at the end, you can hear that he actually signs it.
My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union. I shall do less whenever I shall believe what I am doing hurts the cause, and I shall do more whenever I shall believe doing more will help the cause. I shall try to correct errors when shown to be errors, and I shall adopt new views so fast as they shall appear to be true views. I have here stated my purpose according to my view of official duty, and I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free. Yours, A. Lincoln.
These are relics from the Dixons' home during the Civil War. They lived in Washington. They also kept a home. Their permanent residence was in Hartford, Connecticut. But their home in Washington, there would be certain things that they would bring and attach to the door. The knocker, it's up on the left-hand side, accompanied by Mr. Dixon's nameplate. This was the time in history when there were no street numbers, and they often changed the names of the streets, and the street numbering system would either be corrected or changed. So it was really important that they had nameplates on the front of their homes. Abraham Lincoln had one nameplate just like this in his home in Springfield, Illinois. And also on the right-hand side is the a handbell that each lady would have at by the front door. And when people would call, make their calls, and ask to visit, and they would ring her up a bell, and this was Elizabeth Dixon's own personal bell she took everywhere. It would be able to, she knew the ring of it, and when she heard it, she knew her visitors had have arrived. Now, I mentioned that Lincoln would visit the Dixons regularly. This is a map of Lafayette Square, right by the White House. So you can see the proximity of Elizabeth Dixon's home. It was right in a block of the White House. And the now famous St. John's Church, Episcopal Church that's on Lafayette Square, is also, I identify where that is, just to give reference to just how close Elizabeth Dixon did live to the Lincolns. Made it very convenient for Lincoln to drop in and visit Senator Dixon anytime. In fact, he did. There's a map called Lincoln in Washington by John O'Brien, and it notes all the different sightings of Lincoln and where he visited and when he visited, and describes what occurred during the visit. And it was very helpful because I didn't know exactly where the Dixons lived in Washington. It was very hard to determine, but that map, which is going to be in my show notes, if you would like a copy, it's a great resource for Lincoln enthusiasts walking around Washington, D.C. Well, here is a letter from Mary Lincoln to Mrs. Dixon, January 27th. Dear Mrs. Dixon, please accept these simple bouquet for yourself and ladies. I'm happy to tell you that my little boy is recovering. We've been so deeply afflicted that the least sickness unnerves me, and I'll be ready to accompany you any day to the hospitals when it is pleasant. Very sincerely, etc. Mary Lincoln. Now the newspaper read, "It may not be known that Mrs. Lincoln has contributed more than any lady in Washington from her private purse to alleviate the sufferings of our wounded soldiers, but it's just to add that day by day, her carriage is seen in front of the hospitals where she distributes with her own hands delicacies prepared in the kitchen of the White House, for fear of contamination and the outcries of pestilence fall unheeded upon the ear of those whose mission are mercy." This is an invitation to the White House dinner in February 13th, which is the day after Lincoln's birthday, requesting the presence of the Dixons by the Lincolns. What's not obvious about this invitation is that it wasn't a belated birthday celebration for Lincoln. What it was is just a dinner hosted by the Lincolns for P.T. Barnum's famous general Tom Thumb and his new bride, Lavinia Warren. The Dixons actually, I knew Barnum and Tom Thumb. They had met when they were abroad on the Great Western steamship when they were on their honeymoon. And Elizabeth Dixon wrote in her diary that about Tom Thumb, she said that, the dandy tittle-tat titmouse in plain homespun language with his ringlets always in tight curl and blue embroidered cravat, diamonds and rings, as all he could do, and would take nine of him to make a man. He was always used to always jump over the seat, and I was expecting he would alight in the astral lamp over his head. And if he had, I don't know what we should have ever done to get him out. He was so small. Among Elizabeth Dixon's carte de visites in her album was this.
Anyway, that was a carte de visite that was of Lavinia and her baby. And I kind of put it together she knew her husband, but didn't realize she had gotten to be good friends with Lavinia. And the baby, I don't think the baby lived very long.
This is another map or depiction of Lafayette Square. And this is the headquarters of General Heintzelman. And he was the individual that issued a rail pass for Elizabeth Dixon in 1864. But you could see from this image of Lafayette Square, over on the left-hand side, it's hard to read that, but that's William Seward's house all the way to the left. And all the way to the right is a white building, and that is where the Dixons lived. Actually, it says Riggs Bank, but Riggs Bank was over besides that white building, which was attached where the Dixons lived. And of course, in the middle is the headquarters of Heintzelman.
And Elizabeth Dixon was very good friends with George W. Riggs. I failed to mention that. But considering we've got Karen Riggs sitting there, I thought I'd mention that. She mentions her relationship with George W. Riggs in her Elizabeth Dixon's diary, the 1845 to 1847. Actually, he was an old beau of hers, George W. Riggs was.
So this is the yellow rail pass that was issued by Heintzelman. That's on the left. And then on the right is a photo of Mrs. Dixon with her daughters and some ladies and officers of the Union Army. From a letter that Elizabeth Dixon wrote to her nephew, she described this outing. This picture was taken, that they went to visit the headquarters of General Tyler in Fairfax, Virginia in 1864. They went by rail, and they coincidentally went on the same train from Washington to Fairfax with General Grant. He was also on the same train. And Elizabeth Dixon wrote in this letter that he was wholly stoic in retiring, but has complete confidence of the army entirely. And at Fairfax Station, she said that she took leave, and they were met by officers and cavalrymen who escorted their party into General Tyler's headquarters about 3 miles away. And his house was placed at our disposal, and everything nice and comfortable, French cuisine. And he requested battery review was given to us. For me, it seems like a dream. So Elizabeth Dixon, in the letter, she wrote that it seemed like a dream at the end of this last slide. She also mentioned that it looked, the encampment of troops extended as far as the eyes could see. And this is what she would have seen in 1864, but Hall, the historian, he's holding up a photo of 1864, the encampment that was there. And it's really remarkable. This is exactly what she would see. Now, I mentioned that Elizabeth Dixon had met General Grant on the train heading out from Washington to Fairfax. And we also see that Abraham Lincoln wrote a letter to General Grant. And it says, Lieutenant General Grant, Army of the Potomac, Captain Kinney, of whom I spoke to you as desiring to go on your staff, is now in your camp in the company of Mrs. Senator Dixon. Mrs. Grant and I and some others agreed last night that I should, by this dispatch, kindly call your attention to Captain Kinney. Well, General Grant, he responded immediately the same day. Your dispatch suggesting Captain Kinney for staff appointment just received. I would be glad to accommodate Captain Kinney, but in the selection of staff, I do not want anyone whom I do not personally know to be qualified for the position assigned them. Now, in the previous slide, it was noted that Lincoln had put in a word for Captain Kinney. And of course, that is Mary Kinney, Elizabeth Dixon's sister's son. He is in the top right, to the left of the white post. He is behind the two women. The woman with the hat on the right is Bessie. And the woman on the other side is Clemmy of Captain Kinney. Ernest Kinney, another son of Mary Kinney, is in the foreground. You can see he's in the middle in the foreground with his knee up in the air. That's Ernest Kinney. And General Tyler is seated on the stair next to Elizabeth Dixon, right in the center. It's hard to tell from this picture. There were two sets of brothers in this, the Mahans and Ryan, and I'm afraid one of the brothers on the left that's seated with the hat and the mustache, he does perish in battle within a month. Elizabeth Dixon wrote in a letter that it seems like a dream. Since then, the whole battle command has been in the field. The general was wounded badly in the ankle. Lieutenant Owen wounded in the arm. Ernest also in the arm, not dangerously, however. Captain was badly wounded. Colonel McMahon of New York was killed. One sitting on the top in the hat on the left. What it was awful to me, she said, was that a letter was written by him on the first, and it came only last Saturday, 10 days after he was killed. Oh, he led his men so splendidly. So Mary Lincoln was a regular at the hospitals. She and Elizabeth Dixon would regularly go there to comfort the sick, read to them, and write letters home. Elizabeth Dixon's daughters were nurses in Armory Square Hospital. In a letter written by Harriet Foote Hawley, she describes Armory Hospital, December 25th, 1864, as we trimmed the ward by way of keeping Christmas. Wreath of evergreens hangs on each of the 12 pillars, festoons across the center of the hall. A large garrison flag looped across the far end, while at each end are crosses and stars. Mrs. Foster sent me eight beautiful flowering plants which stand in the windows, and a bouquet of fresh flowers from Miss Dixon on the piano. The next recording you'll hear is of Walt Whitman, describing nurses in Washington.
Oh, we missed that. Apologize.
So in 1864, President Lincoln won a second term, and in March he was inaugurated, and this is the invitation to his second inaugural ball. Again, the Dixons attended, Mrs. Dixon, Mr. Dixon, and their daughters, Clemmy and Bessie, also Mary Kinney, Elizabeth Dixon's sister, and Constance Kinney, her niece. So in 1864, President Lincoln won a second term.
Oh.
And
well, we're not gonna see that one.
This is a letter written by Senator Dixon to Abraham Lincoln following Lincoln's last speech that he gave. To the president, allow me to say it does equal honor to your head and heart. Public opinion here is almost unanimous in its praise. Your views are patriotic, just, and generous. The truth is that you have thus far conducted the war so wisely and successfully that the people are willing to trust you to conclude it according to your best judgment. No man in power has ever before so confided in grateful constituency. We now hope you will be merciful as well as just. Your kindness of heart has endeared you to the popular heart as much as your kindness and fidelity. With the highest regard, your friend and obedient servant, James Dixon. So we're coming to the final days of President Lincoln. And we know of the horror of that night because of that last hour's painting of Lincoln and his death on his deathbed. But also we've got personal letters confirming their experience and actually confirming the close friendship between Mary Lincoln and Elizabeth Dixon. The first letter is Elizabeth Dixon describing the night the events, and she's telling her youngest sister, Louisa.
May 1st, 1865. My dear Louisa, I was strangely associated with Mrs. Lincoln that night, for I had not seen her to speak of all winter, as I had been in mourning. And Bessie and Clemmy each had charge of wards in the hospital. I had devoted myself to the sick and wounded soldiers in their charge, not visiting at all. On Good Friday, I'd been at church all morning and passed the rest of the day at the hospital. And we all came home very tired and went to bed at 9:30. Jamie's in the army, and a young schoolmate and friend of his is staying with us to take care of us. I had been asleep when I was awakened by a carriage driving violently up to the door and stopping. The street was so still, every sound could be heard, and the bell rang loudly. It was just past 11:00, and I heard the colored boy who slept in the basement go to the door and ask who it was. The man answered, "A message from Captain Robert Lincoln for Mrs. Dixon." I immediately thought he had come up from the army and brought some bad news about Jamie, who was probably sick or wounded. I opened the window and my heart standing still, asked what it was. The man answered, "The president is dead, and Captain Robert Lincoln wishes you to come to Mrs. Lincoln as quickly as possible." Of course, I thought that the president had died at the White House, and knowing my familiarity with sickness and death, they had sent for me. So I hastened to dress and summoned Jamie's friend to send for Mrs. Kinney, and then we set off. The man said that the president was murdered at the theater and taken to the house opposite in 10th Street. So we drove there and found it already guarded by the regiment of cavalry. In a back room, over a back building, on a common bedspread, covered with an army blanket and a covered woolen coverlet, lay stretched the murdered president, his life's blood slowly ebbing away. The officers of the government were there, and no lady except Miss Harris, whose dress was splattered with blood, as was Mrs. Lincoln's, who was frantic with grief beside him, calling on him to take her with him, to speak one word to her, but her agonizing appeals were to no avail. I held her and supported her as well as I could, and twice we persuaded her to go into another room. All night long we watched this way, from 11:30 to 7 the next morning. At that hour, just as the day was struggling with the dim candles in the room, we went in again. And Mrs. Lincoln must have noticed a change. For the moment she looked at him, she fainted and fell upon the floor. I caught her in my arms and held her to the window, which was open and the rain falling heavily. She again seated herself by the president, kissing him and calling him every endearing name, the surgeons counting every pulsation and noting every breath gradually growing less and less. And then they asked her to go into the adjoining room, and in 20 minutes came in to say, "It is all over. The president is no more." At 9 o'clock, we took her home to that house so changed for her. And the doctor said she must go immediately to bed. She refused to go into any of the rooms she had previously occupied. "Not there. Oh, not there," she said. And so we took her to the room she had arranged for the president for a summer room to write in. I remained until 11 o'clock, 12 hours from the time I first went to her, and left her a lonely widow. Everything changed for her since she had left so happily the evening before. As I started to go down the stairs, I met the cortege bringing the remains of the murdered president, which were taken into the great stateroom, wrapped in an American flag. Oh, the paths of glory lead but to the grave. When I went to the house in 10th Street, the carriage returned and Mary and Constance came down in it, and have watched with Mrs. Lincoln and been with her frequently since. She's unable to leave her bed and, of course, cannot immediately leave the White House. Your sister very affectionately, Elizabeth L. Dixon.
Now, the second letter that describes the night that President Lincoln died was also written by Elizabeth Dixon, but it was written a year later. And in it, she wrote, "It was such a scene of desolation and horror, truly. I've forbidden artists from putting me into the picture representing the death of the president. I was so haunted by it and so nervous that I could not wish the association perpetuated. Thought it would be very unpleasant to see such a picture advertised or on exhibit. The newspaper reporters have such a way of putting everything into the papers. I told them that I'd pay him if he ever saw our names going into the paper to keep them out. Two days later, on April 17th, Elizabeth Dixon received a lock of hair from Mary Todd Lincoln's cousin with a note that said, "I do myself the pleasure to enclose a lock of the hair of our great and good president, whose untimely death the nation mourns. It is a sad memento, but to you it will recall his great worth and noble character. Your obedient servant, J.B.S. Todd." This is Elizabeth Dixon's pass to President Lincoln's funeral, the White House funeral. She, however, did not attend the funeral. She was upstairs with Mary Lincoln, who also did not attend her husband's funeral. This is the dress that was worn to the funeral, which I still have, and is a very cherished relic.
Trying to get it in the picture. Anyway, we could do that later.
Now, as I mentioned, Mary Lincoln had a difficult time leaving the White House. And this is a newspaper article that was written about that time. "In conversation with a person who's been constantly near Mrs. Lincoln since the death of her husband, we learned that her nervous system recovers slowly from severe and terrible blow. We hope the measure proposed generously by Mr. Roberts will be pressed forward to early and complete success. Let Mrs. Lincoln have assurance that the heart of a great nation beats with sympathy and kindness in this hour of her sore bereavement. No truer testimonial of love for the departed than generously to those he loved." Mary Lincoln was in great debt when she was leaving the White House. She had overspent, some say about $70,000 beyond her means. She was really desperate for money to pay off her debts. And Elizabeth and James Dixon helped her by buying her tester bed that she had slept in while in the White House. It had been lengthened for a very tall person. Lincoln was 6'4", Mary was only 5'2". It was adjusted, so it was a very tall, long, lengthwise bed. Supposedly ushered in out of the White House at night. It was within our family until 1976, when Elizabeth Dixon's granddaughter died, and it was donated to the Connecticut Historical Society. They deaccessioned the bed unbeknownst to the family, and currently someone's sleeping in Mary Lincoln's bed, and they don't know it. Well, we know that Mary Lincoln did not leave the White House for 5 weeks. She did, however, eventually leave and wrote a letter to Elizabeth Dixon 6 months later. Here is Mary Lincoln's letter to Elizabeth Dixon.
having some technical issues with this letter. Well, I will read it to you. Chicago, October 1865. Not if you can, if this sounds loud enough. Yes? Okay, thank you. Notwithstanding weeks have passed since your kind letter was received, yet my saddened memory often recalls you to mind. Your gentleness and tender sympathy can never be forgotten. In the middle of my grief, on that terrible night, which has left me so desolate and brokenhearted, it's often struck me as strange, yet not so, that even while I was so wild in my despair, when Robert said to me, "Mother, what lady shall I go for?" I immediately exclaimed, "Mrs. Dixon and Mrs. Kinney." The scenes we then passed through are continually present with me and will forever bow my head in sorrow and vain regret. Oh, my dear Mrs. Dixon, how painful and harrowing the thought that at the time when my oldest son most required his husband's counsels and guidance, he was deprived of them. And the remembrance of your lovely patriotic daughters often come before me, so different from the young ladies of wealth and position here, who think of nothing but pleasure. Many will rise to call you and yours blessed, and in the gay scenes of life, a little comfort that wonderful recollection. I presume you will very soon think about returning to Washington with Miss and Mrs. Kinney. Will they be there this winter? Oh, I'm indebted to dear Mrs. Kinney for her dear, sweet, charming letter. If I knew her whereabouts, I would reply to it. I've been desiring for some time past, my dear Mrs. Dixon, to be able to get into some boxes deposited in a remote warehouse, as I wish to send your husband and yourself some little relics that once were his, my husband's, and I'm sure they would be valued by you as such. Robert says that until we get into a house, as we're still boarding, I cannot approach the boxes. This is quite sad, I assure you. Yet, if ever the time comes, which I trust it certainly will be here, not before long, you will be remembered. Your husband was most highly esteemed by the president, and how much reason I have had to love you. How dearly I should like to see you all in Connecticut. I trust someday we will be differently situated from present. With regards to your family, I remain always truly Mary Dixon.
Now, the Dixons returned home to their home on Asylum Hill. It was called Rosemount. It was just up the street from Nook Farm, where Harriet Beecher Stowe and Mark Twain lived. It remained in the family for 70 years, and it was sold to the Aetna Insurance Company in 1930. That is where the Aetna headquarters sits today on Farmington Avenue, is where the Dixons used to live. Well, after Mary Lincoln's husband's assassination in 1865, it shattered Mary Lincoln's world. The next 17 years held nothing but sorrow. She was very misunderstood and a tragic figure. She died in 1882 at her sister's home in Springfield, and it was the same house that she had walked as a bride of Abraham Lincoln 40 years earlier. Elizabeth Dixon, she died in 1871, and they wrote that she was a rare woman of social and religious life. Her accomplishments and charming manners made her home the center of refined society. So in 2015, the nation commemorated the 150th anniversary of the death of President Lincoln. And Ford's Theater partnered with National Portrait Gallery and National Park Service, and they hosted around-the-clock public events. And in attendance, I was there with other great-grandchildren of Elizabeth Dixon. And we attended the events. We were there at 11:30 on that, on the 14th, right in the room that Lincoln died at the Peterson House. And we attended the other events all anonymously and then returned to our homes to lead our normal lives. We honor her in anonymity. She would never want a spectacle, you know, brought to her, her presence being there as a comforting friend to Mary Lincoln. So this has been the story of Elizabeth Dixon and her friendship with Mary Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln, along with her family's associations. And I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hello. Hi, Tracy.
Hello, Caroline. We can start our question and answer portion of the program. To anybody who's viewing, at the bottom, sort of to the right on your controls on the bottom of the screen, you can click on the Q&A button and submit your questions online, and Caroline would be happy to answer anything you might want to ask. So far, I have no questions.
I see three chats. Is that between us?
Yes.
Okay.
So if you have any questions for Caroline, just type them in the Q&A box. I got one. Let me see what he's going to ask. This is from Ken Andrews. Why did they travel to Virginia when she received the train pass? Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Is it Kent?
Ken, K-E-N.
Okay. They went to Virginia on the train to visit General Robert O. Tyler, who was the general of some corps. They had just changed all the different corps and when Grant came on, I can't remember the first Connecticut, I think. But that's why they went out to Virginia. We haven't determined where the house is or where that porch is, and it's been very difficult.
My apologies. That question was from Cindy Bington. Mm-hmm. Ken Andrews has not asked a question yet. He just said, hi, Caroline.
Hi there. I know. I think I know who it is. I think we have him in a picture.
Are there any more questions?
Well, the last
I've got another one. This is from Wendy. Cousin Wendy here. Where are you conserving the dress for the funeral? Looks lovely.
Well, it's in a special box. And it's going to be probably, I don't want to keep it forever, but I will keep it while I'm doing, this is the first time I've ever shared this story. First time ever, all of these things. And I have a feeling it'll go to the Connecticut Historical Society, although I don't know, since they already deaccessioned the bed. We'll see. But right now it's in safekeeping here in a special archival box.
Okay. Ken says, no question, just nice to see you and thanks. Iwana Witten wants to know, Caroline, have you done all this research yourself?
I have, however, I've consulted with a lot of historians, such as John O'Brien. He is the author of Lincoln in Washington, as well as Jason Emerson. He is the authoritative expert, I believe, on Mary Lincoln. Harold, you know, all I have communicated with all the major big historians. They all know who I am because it's such an unusual situation having both friendship with the Lincolns. And what you didn't gather is the fact that James Clark Welling, editor of the National Intelligencer, probably he was a foe of Lincoln towards the end.
Okay. Kim Sides would like to know, do you have any other pieces that belong to your family?
Yes, I do. Well, I talked about the bell. You'd recognize that, wouldn't you? Oh, and the knockers, I've got the European diary of, which I didn't talk about, but it is the diary of Elizabeth Dixon in Europe when she goes to on her honeymoon in Europe. This is before the Washington diary that I transcribed and published. So this is fascinating because she meets the King of France and the Pope in the writing. So it's really interesting, but it took me 7 years to transcribe her first diary. And this is probably at least three times as long. So who knows? But it is a project of mine, and COVID has been helping me. I would never have gotten all this other research done unless COVID had happened, truly. Okay. Other things too, I have, I've got her glasses that she wore to the theater. Yes, Wendy, they're similar to yours. We could determine somehow, maybe DNA, who has the right, my cousin's on right now.
Yeah.
She's got, or Debbie's got a pair. I also have Elizabeth Dixon's, her Bible. She may have brought this to the Peterson house. It's old enough. I've got carte de visites of a lot of her friends. Most notably is McClellan, General McClellan, who ran for president in 1864, because I've got a photo album of hers. Thank you, Betsy, my sister, let me borrow this of the carte de visites. And I have, I think it's the container that she kept laudanum in. It's a gold, I I need help with this one. This is, I believe she kept laudanum in it.
I can't see it. Okay. Oh.
You can't tell. We don't know. And of course, this is the fob that Senator Dixon wore on his, there. That's Connecticut, I think, and the Dixon. And one more thing. I have this is her watch on Elsa's Will remembers my brother that at my the grandmother or the grandchild that had all the stuff was Aunt Elsa, and we'd go visit her and she had these in a case. Anyway, I was gonna open it up, but this is Elizabeth Dixon's pocket watch and fan. This is the only one that I can really display. I've got other ones that are all falling apart. But that's it. Thanks, Kim, for asking that.
Rebecca Moore, another cousin, I'm going to let Kent, I'm going to turn the meeting back over to Kent and let him answer this question because they want to know if they can watch the recording because you've got a bunch of other cousins that want to see it. So I'll let Kent answer that one. Iwana Witten wants to know if the Bible contained family information like our family Bible does.
Yes. No, it didn't. It okay. didn't. But I do... the genealogy was done. And you know, that family Bible is so valuable because that is how they determined dower rights. It was a big deal in the old days.
Yep. Okay. I think that's it for the Q&A for now. So I'm going to turn the meeting back over to Kent and perhaps he can address that one question about where can they watch a recorded version?
Thank you.
Thank you, Caroline. That was fascinating to hear about your family's relationship with the Lincolns and their key part in history. The session today has been recorded, and our intent is to have it available on the Society's website. So at that point, we'll see if there's a distribution option that folks who may want it could get a copy of that. I would say follow the Society at this point through the website and on Facebook. That's the easiest during these times. We want to thank everyone for their participation in today's session and your patience as we go through a new style of presenting. And with that, if you have questions that you would like to submit to the Society following this, the email is on the screen. ghmchs@gmail.com. And with that, I thank you for your participation today and take care.